Greetings, welcome to The Dividing Line. It's a Tuesday, I think. It's sort of hard to remember what day of the week it is right now, to be perfectly honest with you, especially for me, because Tuesday, Thursday was, you know, sort of helped me to figure out what day of the week it was. Now it's just all Monday through Friday. It's just all Dividing Line all the time. So, yeah, that's hard. I've had a card here that I wanted to read to you for a while, and I was just looking at it. This is from a young fellow by the name of Josh Hatch, and I'm not sure if he makes cards or just what. I don't know, but it's got a nice cross on the front. It says, "Hello, Dr. White. I wanted to send a little note and thank you for your continued work in preaching the biblical word. About 3 years ago, God began to radically change my life after serving an LDS mission. Within the last couple of months, I have watched every debate you ever did with anyone LDS." Well, we don't have, since I, many of the debates that I actually had with the 5,000 of you guys, LDS missionaries, that I had over the years would not have happened if Jeff Durbin had been standing nearby, or more like Marcus, with a camera. So there were a lot of those debates that will only be seen on the big screen in heaven, shall we say. Anyway, I've watched every debate you ever did with anyone LDS. I have hope that someday God will bring my family out of the LDS church and that I can share the gospel with them as you do, with boldness and complete Christ-centered love. Thank you for being a positive influence in my life. May God bless you, Josh Hatch. Josh, I can't tell you what that kind of thing means. That's why we do the things we do. And it got me thinking, because Josh, you're young. You won't understand this, but you get to my age, you start reminiscing. The wife and I actually, my wife hasn't lost her job, but she's on a month-long unpaid leave. And so we've actually had more time. And, of course, our grandkids are here now. So where is she now? She's with the grandkids. Where else? That's where Nani needs to be, is with the grandkids. And, we have had more time to, sit on the front porch. It ain't a porch, but you sit out front. And, did you know that you can see the White Tank Mountains now almost every single day? I'm not saying that's a good thing, because that means a lot of people are hurting as a result, but you try to find the positive out of it. And every time I turn west on almost any road, look, there are mountains out there. In other words, you never see them, except after a real nice rainstorm for a day or two, maybe you could. But no, in fact, I may put everything aside tonight. No Manichaean presentation, nothing. And go by the storage room and pull my good scope out. I haven't set up a scope in a year. And what? Oh, there's still light, but it's not nearly as bad when you don't have all the dust to reflect it. So the viewing is much better, even in the city right now. I might see what there is to see right now. It's been a long time, and looking at the heavens is a wonderful thing. But anyways, I started reminiscing, and so the wife and I have been sitting out there talking about, well, once you get to my age, I'm not going to mention her age, but once you get to my age, there's lots of stuff to think back upon. And so when I was looking at the card again, I ran into the room right before I got started, and I grabbed my triples. And you'll notice there's two sizes. I was noticing there's not nearly as much in the way of sizes when I was at Deseret Book up there in Salt Lake. I'm not sure they have I didn't see the little mini ones. This I could carry in a pocket, and it's a triple. Book of Mormon, Doctrine and Covenants, Pray Your Price. And you'll see it's got tabs in it up front, purchased May 18th, 1984. At the Deseret Bookstore in Salt Lake City on my second mission trip. So 1984, I bought this one up there. And so this would be the one. Now, even with these, this is tough. I'd have to have the proper. But for example, if you look at the if you look at the Book of Abraham section here, you see all the writing down below, and that's down here is blank space, but you'll notice mine's filled with writing, and that's actually pencil, which is still readable, amazingly. But what I have there is the and later on in the other facsimiles, not sure what got on the pages here, but the other facsimiles as well in the Book of Abraham, I've got stuff written in here as to what like figure number six that Smith says is Olimla, a slave belonging to the prince, is actually the god Anubis, and who Isis is, and who Maat is, and the real interpretation of the Egyptian images I have all written in there. And unless I am forgetting something, I have a feeling, that when you go to section 84 of the Doctrine and Covenants, you'll notice I marked when it allegedly was given, September 22nd, 23rd, 1832. And then you start seeing all this this orange marking in section 84. There's some yellow in there. There's some more orange in here. And what I had done is I had marked this stuff in this little edition. And this is the one that, in fact, I remember Mike Balavo and I were in Motel 6. And I had these, I think I still have these, believe it or not, from 1984, the non-bleed through color markers, orange, yellow, green, and blue were the four colors that you could buy. You bought them at Berean Christian Bookstore at 35th Avenue in Camelback, had them with me, bought this, and we're sitting in our luxurious suite at Motel 6 after eating at Taco Time, and I'm feverishly marking stuff in here. This was what I had in my hand when we went to the, there's section 114 all marked up with dates and stuff like that in there. This is what I had in my hand when we went into the missionary training center in Provo. And this is what I was showing the missionaries. When President Bishop ushered us out and had us kicked off campus by the BYU police many, many years ago. This was the one that I had. And I'm sure I had my, yeah, they both have imprints on them. I assure you, I didn't get that done at the LDS bookstore. this I had done, had to explain it to probably somebody at Berean Christian Bookstore, why they were putting my name on something like that. But yeah, this was put into many, many a pocket for Salt Lake City, Mesa, so on and so forth. That was the carry one. And then we had the reading one. And Rich was mentioning that he ran and got his triple, when I started talking about stuff. And of course, yeah, here's, false prophecies, changes in the Book of Mormon, all stuff, you know, written. Just simply says property of me, but it doesn't have much. But I opened it up, and lo and behold, the same stuff that Rich was playing with that he has in his. Again, the font on this stuff is absurdly small, absolutely absurdly small. But I've got most of the King Follett Funeral Discourse in here. I do remember making this one especially. These are quotes from Bruce R. McConkie on the topic of justification. This was specifically for one general conference in Salt Lake City. We were passing out a particular tract that had to do with justification. And so here's Bruce R. McConkie, Mormon Doctrine, page 408. What then is law of justification? It is simply this: all covenants, contracts, bonds, obligations, oaths, vows, performances, connections, associations, or expectations in which men must abide to be saved and exalted must be entered into and performed in righteousness so that the Holy Spirit can justify the candidate for salvation in what has been done. That's not nowhere near what biblical justification means by a long shot. And all of these quotes just demonstrate that that Mormonism really has no connection, at least historically, didn't have any connection to the biblical concept of justification at all. And it just was not a big issue for them at all. Of course, there's the translation of the facsimiles in the Book of Abraham. I am Jotbi in the house of the Benben in Heliopolis, so exalted and glorious. I am a copulating bull without equal. I am that mighty God in the house of the Benben in Heliopolis, that mighty God. Just slightly different. I think the word "the" appears in both, but that's about the... left middle, O God of the sleeping ones from the time of the creation, O mighty God, Lord of heaven and earth, the netherworld and his great waters, grant that the soul of Osiris Shishank may live. May this tomb never be desecrated. May this soul and its possessor never be desecrated in the netherworlds, et cetera, et cetera. And that's from Michael Dennis Rhodes. That's from BYU Studies. That's why I liked using that particular translation, because, like, actually, it's a Mormon that translated that. But, yeah, all this stuff was sitting in there. Osiris shall be conveyed in the great pool of Khons, and likewise Osiris Hor justified, born to Tikibet justified, after his arms have been placed on his heart, and the breathing permit which Isis made and has writing on his inside and outside has been wrapped in royal linen and placed on his left arm near his heart. The rest of his mummy bandages should be wrapped over it. The man for whom this book has been copied will breathe forever and ever as the Baz of the gods do. Klaus Baer Dialogue, Autumn 1968. So much we could say. About the Book of Abraham and all that fun stuff there. Yes. Yeah. Well, I don't have mine here, but we had these mini carriers.
So let me wait a minute. What happened there?
Went to the wrong camera.
Yeah, I did. Go back to that one and then hit that one. There we go. So since he's showing off his. These little pouches you could get at Deseret, yeah, along with your triple. So
I don't think they have them anymore.
No, they haven't sold these guys for this size for a very long time,
as I recall.
So there's mine. Now, I did have mine engraved at the LDS bookstore.
You did?
I did.
Braver than me.
And then in here is also, this is, look at how big that thing is.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You
sure.
Know? So that was. I didn't want to do a quad because it was too much to carry around.
Oh yeah, quads.
And I think
are
the
huge.
Quads were just coming out for the first time when I got this set.
Oh, okay.
I liked this better, so I did that. But what I did was there was room in here to have.
Right.
Here's my little pocket King James.
Right.
And
do you have
else?
Articles of Faith?
Articles of Faith. Very good, James right. Talmage.
Uh huh.
Okay, that was in there, and then of course, as you're showing off the little laminates that you did way back when. I've got mine right here,
yep,
that I'd have handy. I had some cardboard notes that I could use along
right.
the way that you had made up. You made all these up. And all kinds of little quote sections you want to refer to.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I had this one. And it's like, what is this? Oh, look at that. Can you see it?
No.
The prophet's letter to Governor Carlin on the John C. Bennett affairs.
Oh.
Oops.
That was, wow. You're carrying that around? I don't think I've ever had a conversation about that with somebody on the sidewalk.
I wanted to be prepared for everything.
I guess you were. Well, no, what I did is I carried a camera bag. I started carrying a camera bag for a while.
Yeah.
And literally I'd have, you know, Mormon doctrine and teachings of Prophet Joseph Smith and, you know, a little library there. And again, folks, the reason we did this is we didn't have smartphones back then. You didn't have something like this to be able to put all that kind of stuff on. And sometimes people would challenge what you had to say. And It's good to be able to back it up. It's good to be able to back it up.
Check this out. Check this out. All of these things actually fit in here. It's a little snug.
Yes.
But it actually fit. And that's what I carry with me. And then I did my tracks somewhere. Backpacks were real handy.
those are the days. And it is pretty amazing to be sitting here going, despite the pandemic panic and stuff, all those pageants are going away anyways.
Yeah.
That's what's truly, truly amazing to me, is they've stopped all that stuff. And I think about how they were so aggressive in that was the main way they got contacts for the whole year was through the Easter pageant here in the local area, the Arizona Tempe Mission. And, I don't know what they're doing now. I really don't, but yeah, it was neat to go back and to, those were big investments for us back then. I mean, you got to understand when this ministry started, we had nothing. And I've told a story about when I bought the Journal of Discourses, the 26 volumes in the case bound paperback set of the Journal of Discourses, as a college student, and literally bungee corded it to the back of my motorcycle on my way back home from class, living in the converted garage at my parents' house, having just gotten married at 19 years of age. And how we used those for years. It was $69.99 to buy that set. And I don't know what it would cost now. But then they went out of print for a while after that. And man, did we use that was a great investment. But I was scared to tell the young wife that I had just spent, you know, a third of 2 weeks of our income on, you know, you can't eat the Journal of Discourses. They're not very tasty. So, and then to get these things, but yeah, we've still got them. That was purchased in 84. So we're talking 36 years ago. Got that. Still have it. It's not in bad shape. I take care of my stuff. I really do. But yeah, it just got me thinking about all those years and honestly getting a little sad that we didn't get to do what we were planning on doing in April. Let's hope and pray we get a chance to do that again. I think a lot has fundamentally changed in how a lot of things are going to be done in the future. So, but we will see. We will see about all of that stuff. So a little bit of reminiscing there as we get started. Now, see if I can find this here. Where did it go? There it is. I said that I would read this for you. This could technically be a part of Story Time with Uncle Jimmy, but it doesn't really fit into a funny parameter, so we'll just leave that at there. But I said yesterday, I said, please make a note that so I would remember to read this epistle. Let me talk to you a little bit about a great Christian man that most of you don't know anything about. That's not meant to be insulting. It's just the reality. I think if we were to take a poll of professing Christians in the world, the number who would know of, have read anything by, and be able to place in the proper century, Cyprian of Carthage, would be very small. Very small percentage. And that is to our detriment. I'm very glad that the new president of Phoenix Seminary has written an entire book on Cyprian. In fact, I attended a lecture he gave on Cyprian, along with Peter Gurry was doing some stuff on CBGM, and so it's good that there are people who know, you know, obviously historians know, but I'm really of the opinion here at the Dividing Line Seminary, we're going to have to do something with that, that all of us as believers would be enriched if we were to know better those in whom the Holy Spirit has worked in the past. It does not mean you exalt them. I don't agree with everything Cyprian said. But unlike so many people, and I have especially in mind there, people like Dave Hunt, who was so vitriolic and nasty toward people of the past, because that's the fundamentalist mindset. The fundamentalist mindset is I will only honor those in the past who look like me and dressed like me, which is why fundamentalist church history pretty much ends with, you know, the last century, because you're just not going to find much before then of anybody who looked like a modern day fundamentalist. When you look back at those who came before us, and if you don't know what their context was, it's very easy to anachronistically judge them upon what they should have known rather than what they actually did know. At the same time, I'll be honest with you, I think a lot of the Christians of the past would have good reason to look at us with raised eyebrows. How much in love we are with the things of the world, how attached we are to the things of this life. And I think they could say some pretty strong things to us. And if you don't know about them, you can never have that dialogue. You can never even think those thoughts, even have. One of the beautiful things about church history is that it's the one time that you can have some level of perspective upon yourself. When we look at our own conflicts and our own experiences, our current experience and what's going on with a particular virus and things like that, we get so focused upon the minutiae of right now that having any means of having perspective and stepping back and seeing things in the long term is just lost. Church history is the one time when you can actually hold a mirror up to yourself in a certain sense and have some perspective. Cyprian really helps us a lot in this way. I could not help but thinking, I mentioned, what was it, about, I'm not sure it was a full 2 years yet, but not the last time. I popped up to Inverness just a couple of months ago. Thankfully, you still had ability to do that kind of thing. But about a year before that or so, I was up there and I team taught a class on Cyprian with my dear friend Nick Needham, who is a church historian par excellence. I think that's one of the reasons he and I get along. We can throw out all sorts of strange references to obscure weirdness in church history. And the other one goes, ah. Everybody else in the restaurant's looking at us like, who are those people? But anyway, but he and I team taught a class on Cyprian. It was one of the most enjoyable things I've ever done. I think he enjoyed it as well. The students seemed to really enjoy the interplay between the two of us. And I have threatened to have Nick on, and we could do that again, but for you all. And maybe we'll really need to. It's not like Nick has a lot to be doing right now, so we might be able to ask him to join us in that way. But we, looking at Cyprian, reminded me of one particular thing. Cyprian was only a Christian for 12 years. Maybe 11, depending on where you put the conversion and stuff like that. Conversion dates are always notoriously difficult. But just over a decade, Cyprian was a Christian. And I could not help but think of a modern-day Christian that reminds me in many ways of Cyprian. Not in his theology, writing books, but in having been such a shining, brief star, a meteorite flashing across the sky for just a brief period of time. And one of my heroes of the faith, Keith Green, who was a Christian for only 7 years before his tragic death. Cyprian did not die a natural death. Just some background here. Cyprian was probably born around the year 200. He was a wealthy Roman, well-trained, well-educated. He speaks in one place of the wearing of purple clothes. Now purple linen, silks and things like this in purple were extremely expensive and were a sign of high social standing. And Cyprian knew what it was to wear these things. He was a wealthy man. He had position and status in the Roman community there in Carthage. Now, of course, he had traveled, and of course, the history of the Roman-Carthage Wars is fascinating. As I really want to spend some more time on that because I've not read as deeply into that period as I would like. But when he is converted, he's really converted. And, you know, in our day, when someone's converted, it's like, well, give them a few years to get started, you know, and you've got there's not much expected. Life expectancy wasn't as long back then. There were diseases and plagues, and people died much younger on average than they do today. And you didn't have as much time. Cyprian used his physical wealth to bless the church, not by building buildings. You were taking care of people. He was converted right at the time when the greatest period of persecution was beginning in the history of the church. I've mentioned it many times before, but you need to be aware of the fact that from Nero on, you have intermittent periods and localized periods of persecution of the Christian church. Then, starting in the middle of the 3rd century, you have empire-wide, imperially mandated persecution of Christians that lasts for over 6 decades until the peace of the church in 313. Cyprian is converted right at the beginning of this time period, just before it starts. And in those days, in light of the social situation and how many Christians would be not of the higher classes, they'd be of lower classes, whatever it might be, his ability at rhetoric, speaking, reading, led very quickly to his elevation to the position of bishop there in Carthage, which was a very important position. When that first wave of persecution hit, he chose to follow Jesus's advice, and he left Carthage, and he sought to govern the church by epistle from hiding. And of course, and I wasn't intending to get into all this, but as a background, it is important. My lectures on church history are available online. They're available sermon audio at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church website. They're part of the sermon audio thing. So there's a whole lesson on all of this. But one of the greatest forces that tore at the very fabric of the ancient church was how to deal with apostasy. How do you had people who had been beaten, tortured, imprisoned, they were missing an eye, a limb, their bodies were scarred with lashes, and they had not denied Christ. They were called confessors. And martyrs. Martyr doesn't mean you just have to die. Martyreo means to give witness. And so they would, sometimes living people would be called martyrs as well. But then you had people who did give up the scriptures, who did commit types of acts of apostasy. And the church struggled mightily what to do with someone who repented and came back to the fellowship after the period of persecution had ended. This had been tearing at the church for a long period of time. You had the Novatianist schism, now the Vedanta schism, which was developing at this time. These schisms were extremely... This was what took up the vast majority of social media, okay? The emails of the day, obviously had no E in them, but the emails of the day were taken up with these things. The issue of rebaptism, baptism of heretics, all of these things were central. And Cyprian inherited all this stuff. Remember, he's a Christian for maybe at most 12 years. 12 years. You think you can find in your heart someplace to be at least somewhat gracious toward where someone ends up when they're only a Christian for 12 years? And I'm not talking about he had been a Christian for 12 years and became a bishop. No, he has been a Christian 12 years when he was executed as bishop, became a martyr. He had only been a Christian for a few years when he became bishop. So it's not like he could go to the library and get all sorts of different perspectives and get taught all the biblical backgrounds and all the rest of that kind of stuff. He had to come at it at high speed. And I think you might want to cut the guy some slack as a result. When it comes to a number of different things. But the point is, he tried to run the church, and that's why we have so many of his epistles, is he tried to run the church through epistles. That first wave died down a little bit, he returned, and when the second wave came, he decided he couldn't leave again. He had to stay. He was, of course, criticized for leaving. And maybe because of that criticism, who knows? He does not flee at the second rising of persecution. He is in 258 arrested, and he is executed. He is brought before the proconsul. He confesses to all of his crimes of following Jesus and believing in him and refusing to recant, and he is taken, and he encourages the poor centurion whose job it was to execute him, and he is beheaded by the Roman state and becomes one of the most famous martyr bishops in the early church. And just in passing, I wasn't intending to do this, but just in passing, you need to recognize that because he was a martyr bishop, his views on sacramentology became very important in North Africa. And so when Augustine comes along, approximately a little over 100 and a couple decades later, as Augustine struggles with the Donatist controversy, he has to very carefully disagree with Cyprian's formulation in regards to ex opera operato and ex opera operanti. And he really had to walk a very, very careful line at that point, because Cyprian's memory was held in very high esteem. And because he had been faithful unto death, Cyprian, then what he wrote is given a higher status of authority in the minds of the Christians there in North Africa, for obvious reasons. So that has an impact upon how Augustine has to deal with issues and the things that he faces as well. Because even though Augustine's in Hippo, it's not like it's on another planet from Carthage. Still North Africa, and therefore it's still very, very, very important in his development too. So the point is, that Cyprian is ministering in Carthage at the beginning of a six-decade period of time of imperial persecution of Christians. Many Christians lost their lives. Many a church then experienced what churches in China are experiencing now, being razed to the ground, being dynamited, whatever else you might want to say. This is a very difficult time. The church has experienced this many times before. We might want to be reading more about how Christians have handled this in the past. And one of the epistles that he wrote, I don't remember when I first read this. I don't remember what prompted it. But one of the epistles he wrote was to Nemesianus, Felix, Lucius, another Felix, Lydius, Polyanus, Victor, Yeder, and Dativus, his fellow bishops, also his fellow presbyters and deacons, and the rest of the brethren in the mines. Martyrs of God the Father Almighty and of Jesus Christ our Lord and of God our Preserver, everlasting greeting. In the mines. This is an epistle that Cyprian writes to believers who have been, instead of executed by Rome, they have been enslaved by Rome and forced to work in the mines. Now, if you think working in mines today is dangerous and deadly to your health, try it in the middle of the third century. Without oxygen, without lights, without all the safety stuff that is at least far more prevalent today than it was only 200 years ago. It was a death sentence without being a direct death sentence. And of course, you were bound. You had chains. You weren't going to live long. Let's put it that way. You are a living martyr. So Cyprian would have had in his church the family members of some of these people who are in mines, working in mines. Some might eventually be released. Others would never see their families again. This was a situation that you are facing as Cyprian writes to those who are in the mines. And so if you really want to enter into this, then I think about what it would be like to be chained, to have wooden stocks, to be caused to work for 12 hours a day in stifling heat or cold, depending on the season, smoke from the lamps, choking your lungs, no safety equipment, no breathing equipment. Always, every swing of your pickaxe could result in your death as something might collapse on top of you. And you are there because you refused to deny the name of Christ. Do we have fellow believers in situations like that? There are many today who are facing situations because they will not deny the name of Christ. They could have freedom in China, in certain Muslim countries, if they would but give in. And there were those who did, but many others did not. And so Cyprian writes this epistle. It is epistle number 76, if you want to look it up. I'm sure it's on CCEL. CCEL.org, if you want to look it up. It's in the fifth volume of the Antonicene Fathers set, the old Erdmann's current Hendrickson set, if you want to grab it there. Your glory indeed would demand, most blessed and beloved brethren, that I myself should come to see and to embrace you if the limits of place appointed me did not restrain me. banished as I am for the sake of the confession of the name. So I stopped just for a moment to say this, that would seem to indicate that this is written while Cyprian himself is in hiding, in banishment, away from Carthage during that first period of persecution. But in what way I can, I bring myself into your presence. And even though it is not permitted me to come to you in body and in movement, yet in love and in spirit, I come expressing my mind in my letter, in which mind I joyfully exult in those virtues and praises of yours, counting myself a partaker with you, although not in bodily suffering, yet in community of love. Could I be silent and restrain my voice in stillness when I am made aware of so many and such glorious things concerning my dearest friends, things with which the divine condescension has honored you, so that part of you have already gone before by the consummation of their martyrdom to receive from their Lord the crown of their deserts? Part still abide in the dungeons of the prison, or in the mines and in chains, exhibiting by the very delays of their punishments greater examples for the strengthening and arming of the brethren, advancing by the tediousness of their tortures to the more ample titles of merit, to receive as many payments and heavenly rewards as days are now counted in their punishments. I do not marvel, most brave and blessed brethren, that these things have happened to you in consideration of the desert of your religion and your faith, that the Lord should thus have lifted you to the lofty height of glory by the honor of his glorification, seeing that you have always flourished in his church, guarding the tenor of the faith, keeping firmly the Lord's commands, in simplicity, innocence, in charity, concord, modesty, in humility, diligence in administration, watchfulness in helping those that suffer, mercy in cherishing the poor, constancy in defending the truth, judgment in severity of discipline, and that nothing should be wanting to the example of good deeds in you, even now, in the confession of your voice and the suffering of your body. You provoke the minds of your brethren to divine martyrdom by exhibiting yourselves as leaders of virtue, that while the flock follows its pastors and imitates what it sees to be done by those set over it, it may be crowned with the like merits of obedience by the Lord. But that, being first severely beaten with clubs and ill-used, you have begun by sufferings of that kind, the glorious firstlings of your confession, is not a matter to be execrated by us. For a Christian body is not very greatly terrified at clubs, seeing all its hope is in the wood. The servant of Christ acknowledges the sacrament of his salvation, redeemed by wood to life eternal. He is advanced by wood to the crown. But what wonder if, as golden and silver vessels, you have been committed to the mine that is the home of gold and silver, except that now the nature of the mines is changed, and the places which previously had been accustomed to yield gold and silver have begun to receive them. Moreover, they have put fetters on your feet and have bound your blessed limbs and the temples of God with disgraceful chains, as if the spirit also could be bound with the body, or your gold could be stained by the contact of iron. To men who are dedicated to God and attesting their faith with religious courage, such things are ornaments, not chains. Nor do they bind the feet of the Christian for infamy, but glorify them for a crown. O feet blessedly bound, which are loosed, not by the smith, but by the Lord. O feet blessedly bound, which are guided to paradise in the way of salvation. O feet bound for the present time in the world, that they may be always free with the Lord. O feet lingering for a while among the fetters and crossbars, but to run quickly to Christ on a glorious road. Let cruelty, either envious or malignant, hold you here in its bonds and chains as long as it will. From this earth and from these sufferings, you shall speedily come to the kingdom of heaven. The body is not cherished in the mines with couch and cushions, but it is cherished with the refreshment and solace of Christ. The frame wearied with labors lies prostrate on the ground, but it is no penalty to lie down with Christ. Your limbs unbathed are foul and disfigured with filth and dirt, but within they are spiritually cleansed, although without the flesh is defiled. There the bread is scarce, but man liveth not by bread alone, but by the word of God. Shivering, you want clothing, but he who puts on Christ is both abundantly clothed and adorned. The hair of your half-shorn beard seems repulsive, but since Christ is the head of the man, anything whatever must needs become that head which is illustrious on account of Christ's name. All that deformity, detestable and foul to Gentiles, with what splendor shall it be recompensed? This temporal and brief suffering, how shall it be exchanged for the reward of a bright and eternal honor, when, according to the word of the blessed apostle, the Lord shall change the body of our humiliation, that it may be fashioned like to the body of his brightness? But there cannot be felt any loss of either religion or faith, most beloved brethren, in the fact that now there is given no opportunity there to God's priests for offering and celebrating the divine sacrifices. Yea, you celebrate and offer a sacrifice to God equally precious and glorious, and that will greatly profit you for the retribution of heavenly rewards, since the sacred scripture speaks, saying, the sacrifice of God is a broken spirit, a contrite and humbled heart God doth not despise. You offer this sacrifice to God. You celebrate this sacrifice without intermission, day and night, being made victims to God and exhibiting yourselves as holy and unspotted offerings, as the apostle exhorts and says, I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, and do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. For this it is, which especially pleases God, it is this wherein our works with greater deserts are successful in earning God's good will. This it is which alone the obedience of our faith and devotion can render to the Lord for his great and saving benefits. As the Holy Spirit declares and witnesses in the Psalms, what shall I render, says he, to the Lord for all his benefits toward me? I will take the cup of salvation, and I will call upon the name of the Lord. Precious in the sight of the Lord is the death of his saints. Who would not gladly and readily receive the cup of salvation? Who would not with joy and gladness desire that in which he himself also may render somewhat unto his Lord? Who would not bravely and unfalteringly receive a death precious in the sight of the Lord to please his eyes, who, looking down from above upon us, who are placed in the conflict for his name, approves the willing, assists the struggling, crowns the conquering with the recompense of patience, goodness, and affection, rewarding in us whatever he himself has bestowed and honoring what he has accomplished? For that it is his doing that we conquer, that we attain by the subduing of the adversary to the palm of the greatest contest. The Lord declares and teaches in his gospel, saying, but when they deliver you up, take no thought how or what you shall speak, for it shall be given you in the same hour what you shall speak. For it is not you that speak, but the Spirit of your Father which speaks in you. And again, settle it therefore in your hearts, not to meditate before what you shall answer. For I will give you a mouth and wisdom, which your adversaries shall not be able to resist. In which, indeed, is both the great confidence of believers and the gravest fault of the faithless, that they do not trust him who promises to give his help to those who confess him, and do not, on the other hand, fear him who threatens eternal punishment to those who deny him. All which things, most brave and faithful soldiers of Christ, you have suggested to your brethren, fulfilling in deeds what you previously taught in words, hereafter to be greatest in the kingdom of heaven, as the Lord promises and says, whosoever shall do and teach shall be called the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Moreover, a manifold portion of the people, following your example, have confessed alike with you, and alike have been crowned, associated with you in the bond of the strongest charity, and separated from their prelates neither by the prison nor by the mines, in the number of whom neither are there wanting virgins, in whom the hundredfold are added to the fruit of the sixtyfold, and whom a double glory has advanced to the heavenly crown. In boys also, I courage greater than their age has surpassed their years in the praise of their confession, so that every sex and every age should adorn the blessed flock of your martyrdom. What now must be the vigor, beloved brethren, of your victorious consciousness, what the loftiness of your mind, what exultation and feeling, what triumph in your breast, that every one of you stands near to the promised reward of God, are secure from the judgment of God, walk in the minds with a body captive indeed, but with a heart reigning, that you know Christ is present with you, rejoicing in the endurance of his servants who are ascending by his footsteps and in paths to the eternal kingdoms. You daily expect with joy the saving day of your departure, and already about to withdraw from the world, you are hastening to the rewards of martyrdom and to the divine homes to behold after this darkness of the world the purest light and to receive a glory greater than all sufferings and conflicts, as the apostle witnesses and says, the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that shall be revealed in us. And because now your word is more effectual in prayers, and supplication is more quick to obtain what is sought for in afflictions, seek more eagerly and ask the divine condescension would consummate the confession of all of us, that from this darkness and these snares of the world, God would set us also free with you, sound and glorious, that we who here are united in the bond of charity and peace, and have stood together against the wrongs of heretics and the oppressions of the heathens, may rejoice together in the heavenly kingdom. I bid you, most blessed and most beloved brethren, ever farewell in the Lord, and always and evermore remember me. Well, they wrote back. They wrote back. And it's a brief note, but here's what they wrote back. Gives the names to their brother Cyprian and Lord Eternal Salvation. You speak, dearly beloved Cyprian, in your letters always with deep meaning as suits the condition of the time. By the assiduous reading of which letters, both the wicked are corrected and men of good faith are confirmed. For while you do not cease in your writings to lay bare the hidden mysteries, you thus make us to grow in faith and men from the world to draw near to belief. For by whatever good things you have introduced in your many books, unconsciously you have described yourself to us. For you are greater than all men in discourse, in speech more eloquent, in counsel wiser, in patience more simple, in works more abundant, in abstinence more holy, in obedience more humble, and in good deeds more innocent. And you yourself know, beloved, that our eager wish was that we might see you, our teacher and our lover, attain to the crown of a great confession. For in the proceedings before the proconsul, as a good and true teacher, you first have pronounced that which we, your disciples following you, ought to say before the president. And as a sounding trumpet, you have stirred up God's soldiers, furnished with heavenly arms, to the close encounter. And fighting in the first rank, you have slain the devil with a spiritual sword. You have also ordered the troops of the brethren, on the one hand and on the other, with your words, so that snares were on all sides laid for the enemy, and the severed sinews of the very carcass of the public foe were trodden underfoot. Believe us, dearest, that your innocent spirit is not far from the hundredfold reward, seeing that it has feared neither the first onsets of the world, nor shrunk from going into exile, nor hesitated to leave the city, nor dreaded to dwell in the desert place. And since it furnished many with an example of confession, itself first spoke the martyr witness. For it provoked others to acts of martyrdom by its own example, and not only began to be a companion of the martyrs already departing from the world, but also linked in heavenly friendship with those who should be so. Therefore, they who were condemned give you before God the greatest thanks, beloved Cyprian, that in your letter you have refreshed their suffering breasts. You have healed their limbs wounded with clubs, have loosened their feet bound with fetters, have smoothed the hair of their half-shorn head, have illuminated the darkness of the dungeon, have brought down the mountains of the mind to a smooth surface, have even placed fragrant flowers in their nostrils, and have shut out the foul odor of the smoke. Moreover, your continued gifts and those of our beloved Quirinius, which you sent to be distributed by Herennius, the subdeacon, and Lucian and Maximus and Amantius, the acolytes, provided a supply of whatever had been wanting for the necessities of their bodies. Let us then be in our prayers helpers of one another. Let us ask, as you have bidden us, that we may have God and Christ and the angels as supporters in all our actions. We bid you, Lord and brother, ever heartily farewell, and have us in mind. Greet all who are with you. All ours who are with us love you and greet you and desire to see you. You notice the reference, and have shut out the foul odor of the smoke. I can just imagine what it would be like to be in those mines lit by torches. I don't know how long I could even survive, to be honest with you, or how many of us would survive for a very long period of time. So they are either in exile or bound in prison, working in mines, and their minds are focused upon heavenly things. Could not, you cannot read this type of thing without feeling convicted. You cannot consider the utter deprivation that was theirs of any of the world's goods. Freedom, their families, bare necessity of food, and yet continued faithfulness, and yet focus upon Christ, redemption. They know the faith well enough for Cyprian to use the metal of the nails, the wood of the cross, silver and gold. He can quote scripture to them. And it's meaningful to them. And we face trials and challenges in our day, and I am not diminishing the fact that they are trials and challenges, but it hasn't yet gotten to this point for us in the United States. One of the greatest concerns we have is that the trajectory is toward that which is being happening in China. That's the trajectory. And my suggestion to everyone might want to spend some time not in worldly entertainments and maxing out Netflix, but maybe finding out how Christians before us endured what we may very well be called to endure. The time to be doing that is not once your freedom is gone. The time to be doing that is now. Not then. Not then. Cyprian is very often brought up important in an important way in regards to the development of sacramentology, and he's writing on the unity of the church in regards to the claims of the Roman papacy and all of those things, quite true. But in my experience, especially in survey presentations of church history, which is what all most of us have had, and in fact, almost anybody in seminary, you have so many things to learn and to do in a short period of time. I'm not saying that that's wrong. I'm just simply saying that's the experience. We know names. We know some theological positions. We rarely know anything about the people and their lives themselves. Reading their epistles very often helps with that. And certainly this one in a rather special way. So if you have never heard or read Cyprian's epistle to the martyrs in the mines, then I am honored to be the one to introduce you to it. Do me the favor of introducing others to it. Parents, maybe you might want to talk with your children. Give them the background. Talk to them about who this man Cyprian was, who willingly laid his head upon the block to become a martyr for Christ as a testimony to who Jesus was, and who wrote this letter, and who so brilliantly recognized that in the context that these believers found themselves, there was much to see that pointed to Christ. And in light of just this past weekend, couldn't we say that this is an illustration of how all of the future is illuminated and given meaning in the light of the empty tomb. Because what made all of those comparisons, those similes, metaphors that he utilized meaningful was that these martyrs, whose feet were now fettered, would be free to run to Christ in the kingdom of God. Straight road. None of that's meaningful without the resurrection. And so here in the middle of the third century, and there are so many other centuries since that stone was rolled away, where God has, in his sovereignty, allowed his people, placed his people by his divine decree in mines, in prison. All someday we will see as a tremendous testimony to who he himself is, his goodness, his power, his justice, his mercy, his love. It will all be seen in a way that we cannot in this life possibly imagine. So, there is Cyprian's epistle. Again, it is number 76. Cyprian to Messianus and other martyrs in the mines. If you are Googling and searching, that will be helpful to you to be able to find that. Okay. What do we want? I've got a few things lined up here. A reminder, of course, on Thursday, Lord willing, we'll be joined by Seb Goldswain. And if you weren't with us yesterday, Seb is a virtuoso on the guitar. The jazzy South African Segovia is what I refer to him as. And so he's going to join us. I have ministered at his church, the church where he's a member and does a lot of music and stuff at there in just outside of Durban, South Africa. And in a way that has more meaning than it has had in the past, I truly hope to get to visit again. Right now, I'm not so certain about all those things, but I truly hope that in the future we will have that opportunity to do so. So on Thursday, and then did we verify? And then on Monday of next week, assuming Google and Facebook hasn't shut us down, for any controversial things, you know, any thought that goes against. I never do that. No, I don't. I am fully submissive to Big Brother. We have managed to sneak into the still busy schedule of the rock star himself, the sort of cow farm rock star, but the rock star himself, Milo Hotzenbuehler, who has graced us with his presence a few times in the past. Those are always the most popular programs that we have. And what?
You don't say it right. It's Rockstar. Rockstar.
Let us not talk about your accents. Because that would be a bad thing to do. Milo is going to be with us to tell us about how he is surviving with the cows and the other farm animals out there on the farm, that'll be on Monday. So you'll want to definitely make sure to tune in for that. So looking at what I've got here, I guess what I really do need to do, if we're going to be pressing on at all, is I need to finish the interview from 2018, so that we can then the next step, logical step, aside from the fact that as I have time, and I'm not going to do it tonight. Like I said, my intention right now is to get my telescope out of storage and enjoy God's creation, if at all possible, unless a bunch of clouds move in. But looked pretty clear out when I came in, and I'm not sure when I'm getting up in the morning. I've been told that there's going to be a very close conjunction of the waning moon, Jupiter, Mars, and maybe one other, which would be pretty cool to see. But there are other stuff to see. Albireo, and I'm not sure. And the Orion Nebula is not visible right now, unfortunately, but will be eventually. We'll take a gander at those things. If you're a city dweller and you've never looked up because there's nothing to see, might be a time to fix that. There is a glorious, glorious creation above you. And the scriptures tell us that it testifies of God's power. And it most certainly does. Anyway, the next step in the analysis of and response to the highly unique one-off theory of Dr. Ken Wilson regarding Augustine and Manichaeism and Calvin and Reformed theology. There's where the issue is. It's not the first time people in Augustine's day were accusing him of smuggling Manichaeism into his Christian belief. There's nothing new about that. It's the idea that nobody before Augustine, the dupied stuff, and then this straight line to where modern Reformed theologians are just going, whatever Augustine says, we will simply repeat him without doing that. That whole thing is quite the mess. The next step is in providing the meaningful background. Obviously, if what you're saying, as it has been summarized by Dr. Wilson, is that Reformed theology presents the Manichaean God, we need to know who the Manichaean God was. Now, there's already a few memes and videos bopping around the internet where I have introduced you to certain elements of Manichaean cosmogony that people have found startling or entertaining or a combination of the two. I was sitting out front as the daylight was fading last night, working through a scholarly work on Manichaeism and going, wow, this is a mess. So trying to make it understandable, you might say, do you really want to put that much effort into it? I have to. But it is worthwhile to understand some of the religious context into which the gospel came. Now, obviously, Manny lives over 200 years after Christ, but the church is struggling with Manichaeism, Gnosticism, as well as internal strife in regards to schisms and things like that. So in other words, Manny is contemporaneous with Cyprian. So you could put it that way. But he's not in the Roman Empire. He's farther east. But time-wise, is contemporary of Cyprian. In fact, dies 19 years after Cyprian, but was born almost exact same time. He lives longer than Cyprian because he is martyred somewhat, but not by having his head removed from his body. Anyway, so it's helpful to know these things, to understand these things. And, of course, the main reason that we're doing this is seeking to help as many believers as are interested in these types of things to recognize the importance of doing history accurately and without prejudice. Allow the early writers to be who they were. Don't try to turn them into mirror images of yourself. That will result in a distortion of them and a distortion of you. That's really important. So, with all of that said, I know that I have played preemptively, out of order, a couple of these quotes that I have left. But, so, if I realize that, then I'll go, okay, we're going to comment on this, and I'll just move on from there. But this is the last start here mark I had, so I just got to start someplace, and so let's jump into it.
And you know, you got Phariseeism, you've got the Sadducees, and you got the Essenes.
Yes.
Now, I've read in some places that the Essenes tended to, of those three groups, tended to side on the deterministic ways of thinking. Exactly. And the Essenes were more popular even in Nazareth and the surrounding area where Jesus was actually known in his teaching. Yeah. And it's interesting, I read this too, that the Essenes, it said they kind of went silent for a while there, but it actually connects them to the formation of Gnosticism.
Yes.
And so yeah. Is there any, I don't know if you did much study on the Essenes, but it seems like that of the all the lines of deterministic thinking, it would have been through that line of the Essenes, which, interestingly, in the historical, were the ones who, with their Dead Sea Scrolls and things like that, were found in their Qom and the area that they oversee. I'm not pronouncing that correctly, but I just wondered if you studied any of that yeah. far back in the history of it.
Now, aside from clear evidence that Dr. Flowers has not read the Book of Discipline or any of the other scrolls from Qumran, and really any of the original occupation of the Essene community, the literature that has been spawned by the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls is huge. And, of course, what that means is there are a lot of different takes. Obviously, in the immediate decades right after the discovery of the scrolls, you have people jumping to try to, you know, get their place in the analysis of these things. And then as more of the scrolls would come out, then you'd have a little bit more idea. It's obvious that since this was a library, that it does not have a single, just one single, I mean, there's some astrological stuff in there and things like that. It doesn't have just one single perspective on everything. You can't just assume that, I mean, there are people, and I'm sure that the Essenes and the Qumran community are coextensive. So there's lots of things to be discussed, but what it sounded like, what was being said there by Dr. Flowers was some idea. It almost sounded to me like he was saying that the Essene community might have had something to do with the development of Gnosticism. Now, again, Gnosticism is not just one thing. That's why calling anything a Gnostic interpretation is just simply inaccurate. It's demonstrates you're probably not really familiar with what's going on. But there are wide varieties of understanding amongst Gnostics. And here's something that's important. One of the questions that immediately is raised is the Apostle Paul and the Apostle John both write against Gnostic concepts, or at least concepts that are found within the more fully formed Gnosticism of the second century. So what was Paul warning the Church of Colossae about? What is the nature of the denial of the physical body that is inherent in what 1 John is warning about, that the Antichrist is saying that he did not come in the flesh? Was that some of the bad assumptions have been that what he's writing against is full-blown, developed, second-century, Valentinian, Marcion-type Gnosticism, And it's not. It's a mixture. What's clear, at least in Colossians, is that what you have, what he's responding against, is a mixture of Judaism and early Gnostic, at least Easternized thought. And so maybe what Flowers is talking about here is, well, where would that have come from? Of course, there's next to zero possibility that the Qumran community would have had anything to do with a movement coming into Colossae in the 5th or 6th or 7th century, 6th or 7th decade of the 1st century. So I'm not aware of anyone who can meaningfully comment on the breadth of the influence of the specific teachings of the Qumran community. Anything there is pure speculation. But what's obvious is, what is the greatest influence in the Qumran community? Is this a difficult question to ask? What are they most known for? Well, things like the Isaiah scroll and the Leviticus scroll. Isaiah, the prophet that has that whole section, word for word identical to the way it is today, about God's sovereignty over time and tell me what's going to happen in the future, tell me what happened in the past and why it took place and all this stuff. And so you sort of go, what might have influenced them to believe things like, all my days have been written in your book before they ever were, or you know my thoughts before I ever speak them, or maybe, yeah, it must be, where would they have gotten that while they're writing scrolls of Isaiah? I don't know. So just as in so much of the rest of the stuff in what we're looking at here, the biblical foundation, the biblical influence is just ignored. It's just like, has to have been something else out there. Might have just been spending so much time with, you know, the scriptures might have had something to do with all that. But anyway.
Oh, I did. I went all the way back to ancient Sumer in my thesis. So I spent quite a bit of time on the Qumran community because of that. And they believe that God controls the very breath rate, the heartbeat, everything, every little minute thing is controlled by God in that Qumran community.
There's actually, if you look it up for yourself, if you look up various scholarly articles on the subject of compatibility, compatibilism, determinism, and free will, just put those in plus Qumran. Dozens of articles where it's not just a single, they just believed one thing because they didn't. They recognize, as we recognize, because I believe in the exhaustive nature of God's decree. And so I believe what Ephesians 1:11 plainly teaches. And yet I believe that God is just to judge anyone based upon their actions fulfilling the desires of their heart. So you can dismiss compatibilism. You can mock it if you want. But none of you will ever be able to consistently interpret key passages of Scripture as long as you do so. And listening to you doing handstands, trying to get around Genesis 50 and Isaiah 10 and Acts 4, and confessing that you have to use a different form of hermeneutics to deal with them than you have to deal with anything else is one of the reasons why we don't find your argumentation overly effective.
And guess who influenced them?
Who's that?
Stoicism.
Stoicism.
there's a very definite connection with Stoicism. And the only other Jewish person who we know that dealt more with a deterministic fashion was Philo of Alexandria. Guess where he was influenced? From Stoicism.
So, Stoic determinism and the sovereignty of God found in the book of Isaiah are not the same things by any stretch of the imagination. Anyone who thinks they are is trying to create connections that are not there. They're not fair. They're not being balanced. I mean, and, you know, in this group of people now, all you have to do is say, that's Stoicism. So did Proverbs come up with so much of what it says from Stoicism? Because there are major portions of the Proverbs and material in the Psalter that are perfectly consistent with Stoic philosophy. Why? Because Stoicism, by God's common grace, says a lot of very true things. So unless you buy into the history of religions garbage, where all religions just simply are patchwork quilts of all other religions, then you have to recognize that in certain areas, such as in the expression of wisdom, you're going to find similarities across religious bounds. And Stoicism especially was exactly right when it encouraged self-discipline, self-control, and long-term thinking in its adherence. But its view of the world did not have a personal God who was accomplishing his own self-glorification. And so whatever, you can keep flattening out determinism all you want into just something that isn't meaningful, which is what you've got to do. But honest people are going to look at what Stoicism believed and what Reformed people believe and go, that's not the same thing when it comes to the issue of the nature of God's sovereign decree by any stretch of the imagination. Now, people who don't want to get into all that, they just want to have a bat to throw at Calvinists so you don't have to actually deal with the exegesis. That's, that'll work that way.
Yeah. The debate between foreknowledge and free will and God's sovereignty was going on long before Christ. And Cicero was one that definitely influenced Augustine. And he had to reject foreknowledge in order to get there. So I make it pretty simple when I tell my students that the real question is foreknowledge causative?
Now, this is a... we have discussed this for decades. Since Radio Free Geneva started, whatever it might be, we have discussed the assertion that God can have passive foreknowledge of future events. So in other words, the assertion you're going to hear is that you can know something is going to happen without causing it to happen. And the example that's going to be used is human knowledge. Okay? So Hank Hanegraaff would argue like this back before he went off into Eastern Orthodoxy. Many people who promote, for example, a simple foreknowledge view will say, this is the nature of God's knowledge of future events as well, is that he knows things so well that he knows future events, but he did not determine future events, which then leads you inevitably to the question, who did, or are they all uncaused? And if they are uncaused, how can God have future knowledge of them? The open theist says he can't. The open theist recognizes this doesn't actually work, that you're asserting something, but you've removed its foundation. The foundation for God having infallible, exhaustive knowledge of future events is that God is the creator of time itself and everything therein. That's the one thing that these folks cannot possibly believe. They reject that. But as a Southern Baptist, now I don't know what Ken Wilson's current church membership is, and I don't honestly care that much, but Leighton Flowers is a Southern Baptist, and the Southern Baptists have specifically determined that open theism is outside the bounds of the Southern Baptist Convention. So he can't go there. He has to confess that God has exhaustive knowledge of future events, including the events of free creatures. But why? How can God have that knowledge? Well, God just looks down the corridors of time. Yeah, but that you can't look at something that does not exist. You can't look at something that is theoretical. And so when you press the issue, you go, okay, so God knows infallibly what you are going to have to eat for dinner on Christmas Eve 2021. Yes or no? Now, if you say no, he only knows big events. He only knows there's not going to be a nuclear exchange that's going to wipe you out between now and then. Well, how does he know that? Because something like a nuclear weapon, if one of them is to be triggered, there's going to be many, 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 many people involved with that. There's going to be all sorts of decisions that are going to have to be made on the part of human beings. There's a lot of free will going on there. And if he knows what I'm going to have for dinner, then he knows all of the surrounding things. Think how many free will actions I and tens of thousands of other people, hundreds of thousands of other people, will have to experience before Christmas Eve of 2021. You say, like what? Okay, let me give you an example. I remember years ago, I was riding northbound on 51st Avenue on my bike, and I was passed by an elderly couple in a little pickup truck. I think it was a Saturday morning. Wasn't a lot of traffic. And as I watched the pickup truck and I saw the upcoming light, I all of a sudden realized they're not slowing down. He doesn't realize the light is red. And my eye sees a full-size construction pickup truck, a full-size construction dump truck going westbound. They're going north. And it's amazing how fast your mind can do math. trigonometry. There's nothing I can do. I'm on a bike. And I have a horn to honk. And I watched those two vehicles plow into each other. I'm not sure the couple survived. There was a lot of blood, so I don't know. Now, I will, Lord willing, but in the normal course of events, will ride my bicycle through and drive a car through many intersections between now and Christmas Eve of 2021. And if I do not get hit, there are all sorts of free will choices that have to be involved to keep me from getting hit. So what if someone chooses in their free will to get drunk and to run the red light while I'm going through on the green light? Then I don't live to have dinner on Christmas Eve. So that free will action could falsify God's knowledge of what I'm supposed to eat on Christmas Eve in 2021, right? There are all sorts of those types of choices that will determine whether I live to Christmas Eve of 2021. And so if you say God does know what I'm going to have for dinner on Christmas Eve of 2021, that means he knows all of those decisions, and no one can make a decision other than the one they made, which will result in my having that dinner on Christmas Eve of 2021. That means the entire fabric of time has been woven by creation itself. Right? So it is not the foreknowledge that causes the action. The foreknowledge flows from the act of creation, that God is the creator, which includes not just the primordial condition of the universe, but that's what gives God the right to be able to say, false gods can't tell you what's going to happen in the future. I can. That's what makes him God, and us mere creatures. So foreknowledge isn't causative, but it flows from the one cause, God's creation. So when someone says, we don't need that decree stuff, that decree stuff's bad, God just has foreknowledge. That's not an answer. That's a duh, I know. Can we get to the next? Because philosophers and Christian philosophers have been writing and talking about this stuff from the beginning. So if you're just repeating the surface level, well, God just knows what's going to happen in the future, you haven't even gotten into the topic yet. The question is how? How does that work? How does he have that knowledge? And if all you can do is say, it's a mystery, then you have no ground for criticizing someone who says, actually, we know more than that. Here's the revelation that says that. But if you say it's a mystery, you have no basis for criticizing someone who says, well, the basis is given in Scripture, and it's in God's sovereign decree. Because you're out of the game. You said, I don't know. And once you say, I don't know, then you've got to stop telling people that they're wrong about stuff that you don't know about. So, with that in mind, here is the simple causation argument. Notice that what it requires is that God's knowledge partakes of the same nature as our knowledge does. And that is dangerous and is dangerously untrue.
Is it causative? Because somebody knows something's going to happen, does that make it happen? Is it
right.
Does it
is
cause it, it to happen?
Right.
And so I take a book or I take my glasses and I say, all right, given all that gravity is going to work and there are no exceptions in this case, if I let go of these glasses, what's going to happen? Well,
it's going to fall.
It's going to fall, right? And so I said, you're right. I drop it. And I said, you just caused those glasses to fall. And you go, wait a minute, something's wrong with that picture. And they're right, something's wrong with that picture.
Right.
Foreknowledge is not causative, it's simply foreknowledge.
Right. Well, I loved John Lennox's...
Foreknowledge is not causative, it's just simply knowledge. Okay, well, there you go. Yeah, there we go.
Very important to distinguish that omniscience. I'd like to point out that God is atemporal, off-temporal, that he is living in the past, in the present, and the future all simultaneously. There is no foreknowledge to God. I mean, that's a human anthropomorphism. It's a term we
right.
use.
To think of like looking into the future, right. Yeah.
So he's living at all. So again, when you look at does God cause something to happen, nobody believed he caused everything to happen except the Stoics. And the Gnostics and the Manichaeans.
Okay, seeing this now? That he caused all things to happen. There is no connected, coherent concept of a personal, self-revelational, triune deity that exists between Stoicism, all the multiple forms of Gnosticism, and Manny's wild conglomeration of Iranian, Zoroastrian, Buddhist, Christian mishmash stuff. To connect them in that kind of simplistic fashion is foolishness. It is misleading. It is inaccurate. It is indefensible. But you're listening to it. Okay? You're hearing this. Right? Okay, just want to make sure. The idea of God as creator, monotheistic God, triune revelation, revealing his glory, honor, and power is not found in Stoicism. It is not found in Gnosticism. It is not found in Manichaeism in any way, shape, or form. To say otherwise is to engage in sophistry in its worst level.
Those groups, Christians, again, held to a general sovereignty, that he didn't plan every detail of the universe to happen as the way he wanted to happen. He gave freedom, that he gave, this is going to happen, I'm going to prophesy this through my prophets, this will happen.
How do you know it will happen? Here's a good example. Here's a good example. What is one of the key prophecies that in modern Old Testament studies is taken as evidence that the book in which it is contained was written after the events it prophesied? I'm referring to the fact that the prophecy of Isaiah specifically mentions Cyrus as the king who will free the people. Gives a name. How can that be? That's impossible. God can't know that. Now, I don't know what Wilson's view on that is. There are a lot of people, again, you go to the Christian bookstore, you discover this, that believe that second Isaiah and that was written after Cyrus. Okay, so that's what you're going to find in a bunch of commentaries. Just warn you ahead of time. I don't know what his view is on that, but let's take the prophecy, because he just said God prophesies about stuff. So let's take that as a prophecy. Isaiah says Cyrus is going to do this. Can Cyrus do anything other? And you might say, well, in that one instance, okay, in that one instance, then God's, yeah, he can't do anything other than that. So in that one instance, God's sovereignty is going to overrule human freedom. But in everything else, it God just lets things happen. Do you really think that Cyrus's letting the people go was just simply a one-day, one-person decision? Uninfluenced by anything else, uninfluenced by what's going on in the world, by what wars he's fighting, the political situation. And so I've used an illustration over the years, came up with it probably right after my first kid was born, and you start dealing with the reality of toys left on the floor. What if one morning Cyrus, the great king, gets out of bed and one of the little princes has left the ancient equivalent of a Lego block, you know, all the real sharp ones, on the floor next to the king's bed. And the king's royal foot comes down upon the Lego block, and the royal anger is greatly aroused. And he picks up the ancient equivalent of the Lego block, and he looks at it and realizes it was made by one of those Jewish slaves from Jerusalem. And so he was that day going to let them go. But now he's mad. And so he decides not to. And turns Isaiah the prophet into a liar. Not possible? Someone else couldn't come and influence the king against that decision? They make the free will decision to do that? You see, all these decisions, all these acts in time are complicated webs of free will decisions. And so if you're going to say God can prophesy what's going to happen amongst men, you can't do that and then say, but everything else is just freedom. This general sovereignty is a non-working sovereignty. That's the problem with it. It just doesn't work. You haven't thought it through.
But everything else, I'm going to give some flexibility here.
Right.
That was the view that was held. So just because, as you said, omniscience does not imply ordaining, foreordaining, or planning everything that's going to happen.
So we're being told that there's another book coming out from Dr. Wilson. I'm sure that's going to be really, really, really interesting along those lines.
It doesn't even exist hardly, which is also just, it's like that first 300 years or 400 years of church history. This debate can't be found really.
Okay, I did play this, but let's go ahead and just listen to it real quick.
Yes.
And in Eastern Orthodoxy, it's almost the exact same way. You don't find this parsing of Romans 9 and back and forth and determinism, all that. But in Western, obviously in Western Christianity, you find it all over the place. Why is that? Why is Eastern Orthodoxy, though it has its other issues, obviously every stream of Christian thought, because it's made up of human beings and sinful human beings, that's going to have its problems. But why is it that Eastern Orthodoxy, it's just like this debate or this issue almost virtually doesn't exist?
Good question, Layton. So it's because
okay.
They didn't...
Okay, now what do you think the answer to that is? Because, see, we've spent a lot of time talking about Eastern Orthodoxy recently, right? And I'm pulling up something I've been intending to read here. We've spent a lot of time talking about the emphases in Eastern Orthodoxy, and you've got the concepts of theosis and tradition and, you know, all the rest of this stuff. So what do you think the answer to this question is going to be? It's pretty interesting. Oops, wrong thing here. There we go.
Good question, Layton. So it's because they didn't incorporate Augustine. if we took Augustine out of Western Christianity, we would not be having this debate, right? It's that simple.
So all that stuff like that I read in the last program, you know, from the Epistle to Diognetus that was ignored, didn't have that's none of that there. Don't worry about any of that kind of stuff.
So they did not recognize him as a church father. They kept all the first 300 years of the teachings on who God is and the human free will and how he relates.
Now listen to this. Now I want to deal. I didn't intend to. We're going to four. I'm going to talk a little bit about the East and Augustine because I think it's important. But I want you to listen to this and then ask yourself a simple question. Okay? If you hear what's said here, why shouldn't these guys be Eastern Orthodox? Because what you're about to hear him say is they just kept believing the same stuff that had been believed by everybody for 300 years, all the way back to Christ. Then why don't you believe what the Eastern Orthodox believe? Because you don't. You're some form of Baptist. I can guarantee you something, Dr. Wilson. The Eastern Orthodox are not anti-lordship, free grace evangelicals. Okay? That's not where they're coming from. So what is going on here? I remember when I first heard this, I'm like, really? Okay, just listen for yourself.
So they did not recognize him as a church father. They kept all the first 300 years of the teachings on who God is and the human free will and how he relates with a general sovereignty. And so there's never been a problem. They're still reading the scriptures as the earliest Christians read them. We're only in the West having trouble because we're reading them as the Manichaeans read them through Augustine.
Do you hear that? Western Christianity is reading these texts through a Manichaean lens, but Eastern Orthodoxy isn't. That's Ken Wilson, all right? Grace Theological Seminary, I think. Professor of Systematic Theology, I think. And Church History, I think. Wow. Who knew? But is it true that the East does not consider Augustine early church father, whatever that means. No, it's not. He's wrong. Augustine, and this information was sent to me, again, by a well-credentialed, experienced, highly published church historian. He was officially ranked as a true church teacher by the Fifth Ecumenical Council, which was a basically Eastern council. I'll give you the quote from that. My friend had an Eastern Orthodox friend who, in commenting on an Eastern icon of Augustine, said, "Thank God for the beautiful icon of St. Augustine. I am constantly dismayed by the hagiomachy of those who demonize the great bishop of Hippo." Now, hagiomachy. Hagios is saint. So this would be a detestation of or argument against a saint, and this specifically being the great bishop of Hippo. In other words, what was just done by Ken Wilson. So there are a number, instead of him being called the Doctor of Grace, as he is in the West, Augustine, the East honors him as the Doctor of Piety. And so you have some quotations here. Here's from an Eastern Orthodox source. "The highest quality in him is the profound, sincere piety with which all his works are filled, which without doubt can strike anyone to the depths of his soul by the sincerity of their contrition and warm one by the warmth of the piety, which is so essential on the path of salvation." He has an official saint day in the Greek Orthodox Church, and he's ranked, here's the quote from the Fifth Ecumenical Council. "We further declare that we hold fast to the decrees of the four councils and in every way follow the Holy Fathers, Athanasius, Hilary, Basil, Gregory the Theologian, Gregory of Nyssa, Ambrose, Theophilus, John Chrysostom of Constantinople, Cyril, Augustine, Proculus, Leo, and their writings on the true faith. For with us, the holy multitude of the supernal spirits adorn one Lord Jesus Christ. Moreover, several letters of Augustine of most religious memory, who shone forth resplendent among the African bishops, were read, showing that it was quite right that heretics should be anathematized after death, and this ecclesiastical tradition and the other reverend bishops of Africa have preserved, and the Holy Roman Church as well had anathematized certain bishops after their death, although they had not been accused of any falling from the faith during their lives, and of each we have evidence in our hands." That's called the sentence of the synod from the Fifth Ecumenical Council. And so while there are very anti-Augustinian Eastern Orthodox today, it's more of a modern tradition rather than ancient tradition, and it probably has a lot to do with the fact that since 1054, in the conflict that has existed between the East and the West, Augustine would be frequently cited by those on the West, and therefore that probably has diminished his being viewed amongst those. Was there something you wanted to...
Just so folks don't think that maybe this is an ancient secret that they don't really follow today. Every time the subject of Augustine comes up on the show, we have Eastern Orthodox listeners.
Yeah.
And they go on our Facebook page and they get upset because they acknowledge Augustine and they want us to know that they acknowledge Augustine. So just saying.
Yeah. Well,
that's all.
Okay. All right. And I've had that queued up, I don't know how many times, my sincere thanks to my... I have a good friend who knows a lot about Eastern Orthodoxy, and we have good conversations about those things. I'm gonna go ahead and go to four. I'm going to sneak in the rest of it, and I guess that would help if I reactivate the program.
Other resources that would help somebody that really wants to go back and study for themselves. They want to be good Bereans in the sense of saying, hey, I'm not going to take Dr. Wilson's word for it. I want to go read all this stuff for myself.
So all of you in the provisionist camp that are angry that that's what I'm doing, that I am going deeper than Dr. Wilson did. I'm just doing what Leighton told me to do. I had that queued up. I had to play that part.
The problem is there's nothing else that's been written like this. This is the first time that that's come out and this be exposed in this way in a scholarly manner.
That's dangerous. When you encounter someone who thinks that they are the first ones to have found something, especially when it's in a field where tomes have been written, be very careful. I think this man thinks he's the first person who read all of Augustine in chronological order. He is not. We were talking about the development. For centuries, people have been talking about the development in Augustine's theology. And he may have some interesting point on the editing of a particular, so that it changes a date someplace. That's not relevant to the final thesis. And so when someone really thinks, yeah, I'm the first one that's ever done this, and then they come up with a conclusion that, to my knowledge, nobody else has either come to or is sitting here going, ah, that's pretty good. I've not seen anybody citing it, only the provisionists. Nobody else. I don't see it impacting anybody, and I don't think that it will. Not from what I've looked at. It's not going to be impacting anybody. So be really careful when you run across somebody who says, hey, I got something brand new here.
I had this trouble with James White in my debate where I quote from Clement of Rome, and he says, well, Clement speaks of the elect several times, and yeah, as if speaking of the elect automatically makes you a Calvinist. I'm not sure how that flows, but...
not laughing anymore, are you, Dr. Wilson? Yeah, because that wasn't Clement of Rome, was it? No, it wasn't. And actually, Clement does speak of the elect in a way utterly inconsistent with your own theories. How did that happen? Yeah, it's fun to laugh when you're all on the same side and you're throwing stuff out and misrepresenting me as if I was saying Clement was a Calvinist because he talked about election and I pushed him on that. But if you hadn't said that, Leighton, I never would have gone back and discovered that you were using secondary sources and had never read the actual singular epistle of Clement of Rome and were using other stuff. But how many phone calls did you get from people saying we need to deal with this book? A lot of people. So, you know, you can talk to them about it.
But anyway, speak to that. I mean, what about those who do have lists of quotes from early church fathers that claim they're Calvinistic supporting?
Well, they're not. And if you go back and actually read the entire work, you'll understand that. When you take one little snippet, you
can... Now, listen to what he's going to say here, because I agree with him. It's just not what he himself does. When you read the whole thing, like we did with the Epistle to Diognetus, instead of taking just little snippets, which is exactly what he did. That's what he did to the Epistle to Diognetus. We've documented this now, right? It's out there. Have you seen any meaningful response? I haven't seen it. Have you seen any response at all? I haven't seen any response at all. So we documented this. I would challenge Dr. Wilson. Go ahead and respond to that article on our website. I am so confident of the data and the text. This would be really, really good. You know why? Because you have a narrow field to look at. You don't have a 400-page book. You've got a 10 paragraph epistle. So you can really get specific. So we documented this. He did to the Epistle Diognetus what he's now saying Calvinists do to early church fathers.
Make that say anything. But just like using the word predestination. I mean, a lot of them use predestination. That doesn't mean they're Calvinists. They understood biblical predestination. So we're incorporating our own understanding and meaning into those terms and saying, oh, well, they must be a Calvinist, when they weren't at all. And they were absolutely not.
Right.
If you read the whole context and not just take a little quote, there's nobody who can come away saying, well, this person was a Calvinist. You cannot find them before Augustine.
Before Augustine. So you're not going to be able to find anything in Ambrose. You're not going to be able to find anything in Clement. You're not going to be able to find anything in Diognetus. Nothing. Now, obviously, I agree. None of them were Calvinists. We don't have to say they're a Calvinist. We understand that they had differing views. You're the one saying they all had the exact same view. That's the difference. And that's a huge difference. That's
what the callers kept calling me about, saying, hey, this guy's got all these guys thinking the same way. And that was my red flag immediately, because right. I'm like, no way.
Yeah.
No way. We've done so much. I've heard you do so much in reference to Rome on this that I know better.
Right.
Again, we go back to the white man's burden. That was the chief linchpin in that they didn't think monolithically.
Right.
And Rome needs them to.
Right.
And needs to take everything modern and read it back into them. Every word we use today, that's what they thought about that word, too. Rome does the very same thing.
They do.
And these guys, he's just grabbed that concept and he's ran his own way with it.
Yep. It's got his own thesis to cram back into it.
So if you do that, if you're really honest about it, actually read the whole section and understand it in its context and learn Latin, learn Greek, so you can read it and not get a translation. And then you'll see that those quotes are misrepresented. It's very simple once you understand.
It's very simple once you understand it. And none of those Calvinist guys, they never done anything that I've done. There you go.
Did you find yourself having a bias to say, I'm looking for the free will stuff, I'm just going to skip over anything that doesn't sound like it supports my view? Or were you objective in really studying both sides from both perspectives to try to find the true meaning and intention of the author?
Sure, Layton. I mean, I didn't know. When I started this, I had no clue what these guys were saying and what was going on. So it's very simple.
See, now we're out of time, but I don't want to rush past that. I played that before. That's very troubling to me. I had no idea what these guys were all about. So you were accepted into a PhD program in church history, or was this in the philosophy department? Because I've got the sneaking hunch this was in the philosophy department, not in the church history. I cannot conceive of the church history department allowing this. I really can't. But you're telling me that you got an MDiv at Golden Gate and you had no idea what the background. Because, see, I don't see any acknowledgement on Wilson's part of the fundamental differences, the contexts that would change, that would, between an Origen and a Tertullian. Tertullian's moving the West toward Latin. Origen is still in Greek. There's all this stuff about the different meanings of words between Latin and Greek that had very key issues in regards to the East and the West, in the fourth century, in regards to Christological controversies. The point is, if you really know church history, then you know there are complexities that I do not see reflected in any of the commentary that Ken Wilson gives. So maybe he didn't have any idea. Then he shouldn't be trying to pretend to write about something like this. That's what is really concerning. I'm not going to push past 2 hours. We have maybe 30 seconds worth of quotes left to do. We'll get to them. Like I said, I'm not pushing on with this tomorrow. I'm going to stargaze tonight. So that's just all there is to it. So there you go. Lots of heavy stuff today. Man, if you like church history, you got absolutely overwhelmed. But I hope the last stuff doesn't keep you from really, really, really thinking about Cyprian's words to the martyrs in the mines. I would be really encouraged if I saw sometime over the next couple of weeks, some of you homeschooling parents, you had taken the time, tracked it down. I'll link to it online when I write up the description here. Tracked it down, did a little reading, and then you don't have to read the whole thing, but especially that section about the wood and the gold and the silver and things like that. And had talked to your kids about Christians who were faithful unto death for the name of Jesus. Could someone do that? How about a bunch of you do that? I think that would be awesome. So thanks for watching today. We're supposed to come back again tomorrow. So we'll see. We'll see you then. God bless.